Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with University of New Orleans Professor Emeritus Nii Osundari, whose new book of poems is Green, Sighs for an Ailing Planet. Nii Osundari is a Nigerian poet, playwright, essayist, and human and environmental rights activist. He is Emeritus Distinguished Professor of English at the University of New Orleans and Visiting Professor at the University of Ibadan in Nigeria. Today we're talking about his beautiful new book, Green, Sighs of Our Ailing Planet. Nii, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to be here.
And for me too. Mm. So how are you? How did you fare during the pandemic? I know you've just been in Nigeria.
Yes. Well, like other human beings felt that curtailment of our freedom was something really big. For the first time, I discovered I couldn't go just anywhere I liked. I missed seeing human beings smile, and I also missed the hugs. You know, that little thing that we never see with our eyes really succeeded in keeping us apart. But as I used to tell people then, and I still tell them now because the thing is not yet gone, let's stay apart now so that we can stay together later. You know,
yes.
It was a very intense moment. I seemed to have too much time in my hands because I was at home and was wondering really what to do. Too much of anything is really bad. On the positive side, it set me thinking. In fact, I've been working on the songs of COVID, not David, the songs of COVID, and the volume is garnering new entries virtually every other week.
Wow.
It's a big, big issue, the pandemic.
Well, there's so much to think about. What was the difference you found between being in Nigeria and being here?
In Nigeria, people are rather lackadaisical about this. It's like, it is the foreigner's disease. But I kept, and I still keep telling them, no. We have people here who have been dying of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And I have friends who have been sick of COVID. It's just that Nigeria has been lucky. Nigeria and other African countries north of South Africa. Because at the beginning of this pandemic, that was about February, March 2020, quite a number of experts feared that Africa might lose half of its population from the ravages of COVID, justifiably so, because poor medical situation. And then the COVID protocols are actually impossible to maintain in many parts of Africa. As I said in one of my COVID poems, one of the casualties of the among the protocols really is social distancing. How do social distance on a Lagos bus at peak traffic time?
Oh, yes.
Jam-packed, or the densely populated areas. So we've been lucky. You know, I've been telling my friends who are doctors in Nigeria, we have to do a lot of research into this. How did we miss this tragedy, or how did this tragedy miss us? Many of them are saying it's because of the immunity we've built up over the years trying to fight malaria. So it's in the blood. Fine. And not long ago, I read an article on the internet about a professor who was doing a genetic analysis of it all. I'm always skeptical, even fearful of genetic analysis or genetic differentiations. I don't believe that yet, that there must be something in the genes of people in Africa that has made it impossible for COVID to ravage the people the way it's been ravaging other areas. I think it must be something much more than that. So people were skeptical, you know. I mean, here is a woman who is this is a market woman who has to go to market every day. And her fate and the fate of her family depend upon whatever she's able to make at the end of every day. And are you telling her to stay home? Mm-hmm. And there are no palliatives as we had here in the U.S. Nobody is going to give you anything. No social safety net.
You've traveled so much of the world. I can't wait to see what your COVID poems are like. But these poems are about climate change and global warming and what you've seen in these travels. And you call this Size of Our Ailing Planet. But some of these poems seem to me to be songs. You even speak about what music should accompany them. Some of them are written as elaborate performance pieces with acts and things like that. So talk to me a little bit about the difference between a sigh and a song.
Yeah. To begin with, the meeting point is music. Yeah. Music is meaning, and meaning is music. I come from a very musical background, a background in which drums don't just sound differently, they also mean differently. A sigh is an expression that comes from inside the human being. It rises from the pit of the stomach, as it were, locks in the heart for quite a long time before seeking exit through the human mouth or human nose or whatever. So the sigh is physiological, is psychological, is emotional, and it could also be therapeutic.
So
the sigh. I remember some of Shakespeare's plays, especially the romantic comedies. Oh, no sooner did they see than they sighed. You know, the sigh is an expression, yes, of desire, of longing too. Yes, my original title for subtitle for the book actually is "Size of Our Dying Planet." It was towards the end. I said, no, dying. No, our Earth is not going to die. That's the last poem in the book that preceded this. Well, The Eye of the Earth is the title, and it was published in 1986. The Eye of the Earth. Every poem there is about the environment. That was before the Kyoto Agreement on climate change. You know, I have always been involved with the planet, with climate change, and so on. So sighs, yes, the sighs are there. A sigh may indicate the presence of weakness. It may also indicate a sign of release, of relief. That's where it becomes therapeutic. Where the song, we all know, That vocal expression, that vocal articulation, which we produce with the help of the human body. So the sigh and the song are related. Now, as far as my suggestion of different musical instruments is concerned. Well, I've been doing this since I started writing, really. Because for me, poetry is not just something trapped within the two covers of a book. Poetry is the word, and the word receives animation through the sounding. Sounding is meaning, and meaning is sounding. In many of the poems, we have to interpret the lines through the kind of music. And in some poems, the music changes according to the tempo and tenor of the stanzas. And this is dictated by what those stanzas are saying. So it's a way of... because the facts in this book are stark in many areas, really, really blatant, deliberately so, because I'm trying to tell the world we've been too complacent for so long. We are killing the earth, we are killing the planet. But if it is too blatant, you may alienate your audience. So why don't you introduce music into it? Something that we make the tablet a little easier to swallow.
Swallow, yes. So would you read for us Early Spring in City Park? There's so much of New Orleans in this book, and I love that so much.
Oh, thank you, Susan. It's not possible to live in New Orleans and not poeticize this city, because New Orleans poeticizes all of us.
It does.
It's one of the reasons my family and I chose this place about 25 years ago. A lot of music here. Early Spring in City Park. Northern winds have beaten a cold retreat to their Arctic road. The oaks, ever so alive, break into olive sweat, their moss Spanish and smoothly gray, swinging soberly like a griot's beard. New poems erupt at the end of silent branches, their music mellow from the green prosody of the wind. A joyous squirrel ruffles the air with its restless tail, its pranks lean, its chuckling one moon from mature laughter. My eyes memorize these lines from the book of a wild awakening. The hibiscus's precocious budding, a riot of pollens seeking anchor in friendly places. The throaty serenade of mallard ducks gliding enviably on the chilly lake. Ah, summer's song is still a foliage away. I encounter the sun's resurrection in the leafing Galilee of Louisiana oaks.
Ah, oh, the Galilee of Louisiana oaks. I can see it. I can see it. And the hibiscus, too.
And the hibiscus, yes.
Another thing you do is write poems for specific people. Like, I love your poem for Greta Thunberg. You know, she dared. She dared to ask these questions. Mm. And you write also about a lot of Nigerian writers that I might not be familiar with. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about those figures.
Yeah, sure. Oh, yeah. One point I didn't really touch, the last one. Food.
Yes.
The centrality of food. Food is not just that bit you put in your mouth, you chew up, and so as to stay alive. Yes, we stay alive through it. But food is also a symbol. Food is a part of a great human festival. Fruit is the positive end, the positive epilogue, if you like, of plenitude, of the work of the farmer. And it is a celebration, too, of the bounty that our earth has produced for us. It is not possible to talk about the environment without talking about what we do with the earth and how we have to treat the earth so as to keep it giving us more and more and more. Yes, Greta Thunberg. Yes, I look forward to meeting that young lady someday. She reminds me of a Yoruba saying, when the elder is behaving like a child, the child takes it upon himself or herself to behave like an adult. That's right. Mm-hmm. When she mounted the rostrum, the United Nations Assembly, and shouted a question. Yes, I said, thank you very much. Tell us more. There are times when the situation is grim. Adults have to learn some wisdom from the mouth of children. Now, her Nigerian counterpart, Ken Saro-Wiwa,
yes,
who was hanged by the military junta in Nigeria, was a friend of mine and a fellow writer, a fellow Nigerian writer. And I remember shortly before he was hanged, well, I was in Nigeria then teaching at the university. Sunday morning, he brought a copy of his latest book then, I think, This Darkling Plain. The title of that book is taken from Arnold's poem,
Dover Beach.
Yes, This Darkling Plain. And he said, come, this book is one of the first six copies they've given me. I'm giving you this. Read it. If you feel you should review it. Do whatever you like with it. And if I'm still alive, I will read the review. And I said, okay, no, you're going to be alive. I said, well, I don't know. I want to live, but... he was already having the intimations, as it were. Took the book, read it, and so on. It was just a couple of months later. That was November 10, 1995. I was even in the UK then. I was a Cadbury Fellow at the University of Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And I had an invitation to give a talk and a reading at the University of Edinburgh. I was on the train between... Birmingham and Edinburgh, when news broke around the world that that Nigerian writer had been hanged. So by the time I got to Edinburgh, the faces of my colleagues were swollen, as it were. They didn't have to say much because I knew what had happened. My lecture that day had to be amended in a way. You know, mm-hmm. The first two pages, yeah, really talking about the undeniable relationship between literature and politics. You know, he did that, but he was a writer, and that led him to being an activist. So, and then the Niger Delta in Nigeria, there are so many of us writing about that place. I don't come from there, but many of my friends are from there. Great writers. That's why I'm saying they're singing between the tides. The Niger Delta is the goose that lays Nigeria's golden egg, as it were. It has been devastated by the oil companies. Mm. That's where Ken Saro-Wiwa was from, really. The rivers, beautiful place. The rivers have been polluted, no accountability at all. Then there is gas flaring 24/7. So the difference between night and day has been erased. This has affected people, and people are falling sick. Farmers can no longer farm. Fishermen and women can no longer fish. So we're talking about the environment. We're talking about our planet. You know, we are talking about things that are essentially human. So I have always been involved with this, a way of really telling us, as Shakespeare would say, the play is the thing. This time around, the poem is the thing with which we are going to stir the king's conscience. Ah. Humanity has been complacent, quiet, ignorant, willfully ignorant for too long. Our planet is imperiled.
Well, since you've spoken so beautifully about rivers, I wonder if you'd read that poem, Wishes, which talks so much about rivers you've seen.
Wishes. Wish I could still laugh with the lotus on the bank of the Nile, take off my clothes and dive into the Zambezi, join spirit dancers in the middle of the Ganges, romp with the Rio to the thunder of the Samba. Fan the youngster's face with the feathers of the moon. Tease the Thames with a shoeless foot. Embrace the Volga with open arms. Ask the Mississippi for a bowl of water. Ah, alas, between cup and lip, an acre of wishes.
Wishes. Oh. I love the way this book saddens us but inspires us all at the same time. And I love two words together, the last poem, stubborn hope. Because hope should always be stubborn. It should always be active, and it should be our work. Hope is our work, I think, don't you?
Yes. I confess to my plagiarism. Stubborn Hope is actually the title of one of the best-known collections of Dennis Brutus from South Africa. He was in Robben Island with Nelson Mandela.
Oh,
yes, one of those that were put away by the apartheid regime at that time. I think there was a time he was shot and wounded because they said he was trying to escape. Eventually, he made it out and got a job at the University of Pittsburgh in the USA. And that's where he was many, many years before he died. One of his books is titled Stubborn Hope. We were taught that book when we were undergraduates. Yes, Stubborn Hope. Hope has always been there for me. Because in 1991, as an acceptance speech for the Norma Award, that was in Harare in Zimbabwe, I think I ended that speech with a short paragraph that often and normally we say that as long as there is life, there is hope. But in Africa, as I knew it then, and as I still know it, we need to recalibrate that saying. As long as there is hope, there is life. The human being could live for a couple of days without food. The human being could live maybe much shorter without water. The human being cannot live without hope for 1 second.
So true. So true. Thank you. We've been talking with poet, playwright, essayist Niyi Osundari, whose new book is Green, Size of Our Ailing Planet. Niyi, thank you so much.
It's you I should thank, Susan.
Oh.
We appreciate all you've been doing for the book and for the advancement of the creative mind.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. David J. Dennis Jr., whose new book is The Movement Made Us, A Father, A Son, and the Legacy of a Freedom Ride, appears Friday, May 13th at 7:30 at Baldwin & Company in a conversation moderated by Cherise Gibson. Karen Conearth, creator of the book Calliope Kate and the Voice of the River, presents a puppet theater version of that story and signs her book Saturday, May 14th at 11 a.m. at Garden District Bookshop. New York Times reporters Jonathan Martin and Alexander Burns celebrate the release of This Will Not Pass, Trump, Biden, and the Battle for America's Future, in a conversation with Walter Isaacson, Saturday, May 14th at Garden District Bookshop. Doors open at 6, tickets available at gardendistrictbookshop.com. Ellen Byron celebrates the launch of her latest cozy mystery, Bayou Book Thief, which will be officially released on June 7th, but she appears in conversation with fellow local mystery author Greg Heron, Sunday, May 15th at 5 at Blue Cypress Books. This is a ticketed event. The 7th annual Walker Percy Weekend takes place June 3rd through 5th in St. Francisville, complete with beer, bourbon, barbecue, and lots of great conversation. Check out walkerpercyweekend.org for tickets. Speakers this year include Chris Baglow of Notre Dame University, Jody Blanco, co-author of I, John Kennedy Toole, a novel that traces the origins of a Confederacy of Dunces, John Shelton Reed, author of 22 books, most recently Barbecue, and Reed Mercer Shushart, who will discuss the many movies of the moviegoer. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.